This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. So the prevailing stereotype of Southern food can still be explained with just a few adjectives: fried, fattening, greasy, and oh so comforting. But a group of students and scholars and activists are gathering at UNC Chapel Hill later this week to take a fresh look at what is in the skillet in Southern kitchens. The State of the Plate Conference features six different panel discussions centered on flavor profiles like hot, sweet, and sharp. Each panel will talk about particular kinds of foods and look at what food can tell us about place and community, public health, history, and politics. We're going to talk to a number of these panelists today. We're going to start with the chair of the conference, Marcy Cohen Ferris, is a professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. She recently authored the book, The Edible South, The Power of Food and the Making of an American Region. And she is back with us now. Marcy, so good to have you back.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Frank. Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. Tell us about the impetus behind this conference.
Well, this is a conference that's been sponsored by the Center for Global Initiatives at UNC for almost 10 years. And it focuses on a different theme each year. And food and food studies is really the focus this year, which is exciting. We're about to begin on a big pan-university study of food for the next couple of years. So this actually kind of kicks it off with this great conference that looks not only at North Carolina food worlds, but kind of global connections to food studies, too.
Pan food studies is the perfect pun, and thank you for that.
Cast iron pan.
Well, and global initiatives. University. And I think this is so important to point out that food is universal and it is particular. And that's the great thing about food, right? I mean, that's part of the message here.
Right, right. You know, that there are so many ways that when we look at food cultures in North Carolina, we think that this is a very local kind of discussion, but it's really a global discussion, as everything about the South always has been from the get-go.
And Southern history is so important. I mean, one of the more interesting things I read in your book is this notion of how our ideas about food has changed. As early as the turn of the 20th century, that good old home cooking in the mountains that we might have come to expect around the early 1900s had already changed because of industrialization.
It's exactly right. And that's really a big issue when we start to look at the New South, at the modern South, and how kind of the regional foodways, you know, it was a way of kind of reconnecting the South to the nation, and that was through branding kind of regional foodways and food cultures, selling the food cultures of Appalachia, of Western Carolina, selling kind of low country foodways, even of the coastal South, of New Orleans, of all these different regions, and really branding Dixie was a really powerful idea.
Well, and the idea that whole schools were formed, or, you know, at settlement schools, industrial schools, that would teach kind of home economics and teaching what has since become the idea of Appalachian and Southern food.
That's right. And there's a really one of our terrific scholars in Carolina, Elizabeth Engelhardt, does a lot of work in this area connected to food studies and looking at Appalachia and looking at how those, you know, do-gooders, you know, came into Appalachia and into settlement schools and tried to change the basic food ways, you know, try to help women switch from cornbread, you know, to white flour and raised bread, you know, and people were not anxious to do that.
Not happy to do it. And interestingly enough, there's a kind of racial cultural overtones in some of this. You know, the idea of rice pudding is something that would be fairly nutritious, perhaps, but awfully white.
A whitening of food is really a theme that you see in the modern South, in the New South. And this has, you know, we think of food and kind of there's politics behind food, right? And there's politics behind Southern food history. And this isn't benign. You know, there was a lot of racial politics to kind of the whitening of a variety of dishes at the turn of the 20th century.
And it often papers over some of the important economic changes that are really going on, serious changes that are happening in these regions. To help us understand a little more about that, I'm joined by another of the conference panelists, Karen Willis Amspacker. Karen is director of the Core Sound Waterfowl Museum and Heritage Center on Harkers Island. And it turns out, the person who is responsible for my favorite cookbook, the Harkers Island Cookbook. So welcome to the State of Things. I didn't know
Glad
you were the one to put that together.
Glad to be here.
It's a great book. But when we talk about this changing, I mean, if people think about what are they eating on Core Sound, they're eating a lot of seafood, and there's fishermen, fisher people coming and going. Things have changed an awful lot there, haven't they?
They have changed. The landscape has changed. Our diet is changing. the commercial fishing industry is changing. But to survive, it has to. It has to adapt to what's going on around it. People assume that when they come to the coast, they're eating something that came to the dock that morning, and that's not necessarily the case. So the work that I do with NC Catch and the local branding programs for local seafood are trying to educate consumers to ask, always ask, who caught it, where, when. That's the key.
Are there any challenges these days to providing lots of food that was caught that day or a day before?
Always challenges in the fishing industry, and the fishermen will tell you that regulation is the number one challenge, and I'm not going to argue that point. But the reality is that fishermen, to stay on the water, you know, the industry is shrinking, it is aging, but there are new opportunities, and social media has helped make that happen. CSA converted to CSF, Community Supported Fisheries, is making that happen. Chefs and restaurants inland are demanding local seafood, and that is opening doors for local fishermen at the small scale, that they can sell their product direct to a consumer, to a restaurant, to a market. How can we open up these ways of communication and distribution to keep our seafood in this state?
And in time, tell us a little about the history of Harker's Island, and is it true there's not a single fish house on the island?
It is true. I grew up on Harker's Island. My great-grandfather came there in 1903 from Shackelford Banks, and everything I am and do, like anybody else from Harker's Island, is because of Harker's Island. But Harker's Island is changing. We've not had a fish house on there in the past maybe 5-6 years. We do have one fish market, which is a semi-fish house. They do buy from other folks, but it is quickly becoming a retirement community.
Well, tell us, for those of us who were born inland, what is the fish house? What happens?
A fish house is the place where boats dock up to the back door and unload their catch. That's where the ice is. That's where the packing and the sorting and the grading happens. And then many times, most of the time, it goes out the front door on a truck. And traditionally, it's headed north to Fulton's, Baltimore, those markets. Now, some of them are traveling, you know, west. They're coming to Raleigh, to Winston-Salem, Asheville, you know, big food hub. We're trying more and more to get those products moving east and west.
Well, it's a delight. I'm a member of the CSF that delivers over here at Duke every Thursday, and it has been a real delight to learn about, first of all, species I never knew anything about, and but also to get that kind of fresh fish and be pretty sure that it has actually come from
the coast. Well, that's the commitment of the CSF, and Walking Fish does a great job, as does Corsine Seafood. And what we've talked about is how important that relationship is. I just got home from 2 days at Ocracoke at the Catch Summit, and the Department of Ag and others in the industry have said people are buying the story. I think that's true with the farmers. You want to put face on your food. And so we're looking at ways, how can we get the picture of that fisherman on that menu? You know, Bass Knight's Lone Cedar Restaurant in Manio is committed to 100% North Carolina seafood. They post the picture of the fisherman who caught the catch of the day at the door. So, yeah, that's what people are buying, and they're willing to pay a premium price.
And the way it's happening, or at least working in agriculture, is that farmers are realizing there's a lot of value added that happens after they're done with it, when it leaves the farm, and that integrating that, the developing co-ops and other ways of becoming a part of the value added chain, is keeping the fisher people and certainly the farmers in business.
Well, that case has played out in a very positive manner on Ocracoke. Our community, the old coast of North Carolina, was defined by commercial fishing. My comrade and now county commissioner, former fisherman, he said that, you know, fishermen built this community. They built the courthouses and the schools and the businesses. And that is true. The infrastructure of these coastal communities was first built by the fishermen. And we have to hold on to that. There's not a person born on Harker's Island or any other community that their family was not involved in commercial fishing. You know, many have gone on to other fields and done other things, but at our heart, we are fisher people.
Now, Marcy, we haven't offered a single recipe in this last conversation we had about the changing kind of the nature, particularly along the waterfront. And yet, as someone who studies the intersection of the variety of foodways in North Carolina, how does Karen's work and what we're talking about here resonate with foodways and some of what you're studying?
Oh, this work is critical. And Karen actually came and spoke to – we have a new class that my colleague Sharon Holland and I are teaching called Carolina Cooks, Carolina Eats. And it really looks at the food voices of North Carolinians, you know, and we're not just concerned about cuisine and about cooking, but by the politics, by the issues, by the challenges, by the environment, by all the economic issues that y'all are talking about today. But when Karen came and she brought Morty Gaskell, who's a young fisherman who's living in, he's at NC State and he's from at Ocracoke, and they both spoke to us about that. They said to our students, this is your heritage. This belongs to you. You know, you have to care about this. This is your fish. And, you know, you own it. You deserve it. You have a right to it. And that really opened up minds in my mind and our and I think our students also, that we also began to understand this is part of this local food movement. And often, you know, we're so centered on the farmers in our region in the Piedmont that we don't think about the coast, but we got it.
No, and when you're in North Carolina, the sheer variety of food that you can have year-round, and then you include seafood, is a blessing that is bestowed on few people on this planet. And so keeping it safe is obviously something that you're all interested in. But the other thing is, when we think about energy self-sufficiency, there's a lot of political energy behind our oil and our coal and keeping it safe. And I wonder if there's the same kind of energy about our food shed and making sure that we have in place the infrastructure and the regulations that allow for that. Karen?
Our communities are very committed to water quality. Water quality is everything. Neuse River and Pamlico Sines still have not recovered from Hurricane Floyd. How many years? 12 years ago? Water quality is everything. That what's in the water is determined by what happens on the land. So we're very conscious of that. We're very watching very closely what happens with the offshore drilling issue. So we understand regulation better than anybody. The North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries, that is their job, species by species, to manage the stocks. And there's always conflict and tension in that process, because for fishermen, I say, and I do believe, that they are the greatest of conservators. It's their future that they're fishing. Why would they go and destroy habitat, or why would they go take it all this year? Because they want to be back next year.
Well, it seems to me, and there's a tension, I know, between the recreational and commercial fishing industries. And I find it a little surprising in a way, because if you're attracting commercial fishermen or recreational fishermen and you want tourists and people to settle, isn't part of what you're selling the fish house and the commercial industry, people bringing in those big catches, isn't that part of why you go to the B&B and catch some fish?
And for the most part, the recreational fishermen who come, they appreciate that. After they get through fishing, they want to go to a restaurant and eat local seafood. So I would say that the greatest issues within the recreational versus commercial fishing is a small group. We have always welcomed the recreational charter boat folks who come for the weekend. We need those dollars. That's part of our economy now. Actually, it's in the cookbook, the Captain Stacy Fleet that helped make Morehead City famous started on Harker's Island. They first chartered off of Shell Point, as did Jimmy Harker and the Carolina Princess. So we've welcomed people to come and fish hook and line. I don't understand hook and line. Catching fish one at a time just don't make sense. It's like to me, if you want fish, you set a net. But, that it's there. But there's room for everybody.
And Karen, you have never caught a smallmouth bass, I will tell you. You would know
I've
right away.
I've never eaten one either.
Marcy, this conference looks at North Carolina foodways not only from the perspective of a state resident and what we can enjoy here, but also the global South. That's an interesting perspective. Tell us more.
Right. Well, you know, everything that we do here in North Carolina is shaped by the planet that we live on and our deep connections with the rest of the world. And so global studies and understanding North Carolina and Carolina's world within it as scholars and as students, as faculty, and within our community is central to the conference. So that's what we're looking at. It's making all these different connections. So we've got a variety of people on these different flavor panels, you know, hot, smoky, sweet, bitter, sour. And you can see those are classic flavors of kind of the core foundational, you know, cuisine of the South, but they also reflect bitterness connected to race, the kind of sourness that we have in the politics connected to the fishery industries that we're talking about. But Rachel Willis, who's an economist in American Studies, she'll be talking about global warming's impact on North Carolina pork industry. We're looking at migrant farm labor in the state. Obviously, that's got huge global connections. We're looking at the history of fast food in the state. Fitz Brundage and Peter Kaklanis, both eminent Southern historians. And fast food is definitely global.
We are talking about the state of the plate today on The State of Things. Marcy Cohen Ferris is with us, a professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, as Karen Willis Amspacker, director of the Core Sound Waterfall Museum and Heritage Center. Karen, what are some of the initiatives? I know that underutilized seafood, I mean, one of the great things about being part of Walking Fish for me, the CSF, is I've been introduced to all these species of fish that I didn't know were down there, and I've learned to cook them and really enjoy them. But I guess if we knew more about some of those underutilized species, things would get better for all of us, huh?
That's a big effort with North Carolina Sea Grant and NC Catch and the fishing industry in general. North Carolina has more different species of fish than any other Atlantic coast state because we are the meeting place of the North Atlantic Current and the Gulf Stream. So we and therefore we have more management plans to live under and more councils to be in their jurisdiction. So there is a catch-22, but there are lots of species that people are not used to eating. Ribbon fish and trigger fish and sheep's head. Croaker. Croaker that was a trash fish when I grew up. Now it's selling for $4 or $5 a pound. I don't, who would have thought? Fall spots. People inland didn't eat spots. My family, we ate spots every day. So, yes, we're trying very hard to look at what's there, what can be harvested. We're even looking at community, low-income communities. They deserve some fish. It's their fish. We've talked about the public trust resource. Those fish belong to everybody, and that's what makes a commercial fishing industry viable. Not everybody has the time or the resources to come in their own boat to go fishing to catch their flounder for the day. Commercial fish are harvesters. They are in the food business. And so how can we make seafood more accessible to more people? That's a real initiative with what we're trying to do.
Well, what's interesting about this, too, is a century ago when we thought that all of our resources were boundless and we could do whatever we want to our rivers and our streams and our oceans, regulation became a problem and there was a lot of tension about it. Now, if it's your industry and that's the business you're in, you're understanding that there is a limit to this and that being a party at the table when the regulations are created is your future. And so I think it's a whole different mindset now about conservation.
I think this generation, fishermen have accepted that there needs to be management, there need to be regulations. I think the key is not only what is done, but how it's done, and that the fishermen do have a say because they're the ones on the water every day.
So what are your hopes going forward for the fishing community on Harkers Island?
To keep those men and women in the water, to get the best price possible. I had somebody say to me, shrimp were expensive last year. The price never dropped. And I said, good. That's going to keep those guys in the water. So how can we gain respect for the product, for the men and women who harvest it? How can we maintain these communities and this culture, keep some fish houses operating? That's our goals.
Karen Willis Amspacker is the director of the Core Sound Waterfall Museum and Heritage Center and one of the panelists at the State of the Plate Conference. Marcy Cohen Ferris is the director. She helped pull that conference together with many, many others, and she will stay with us as our conversation continues on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking about the State of the Plate, What is for Lunch? A conference bringing together students, faculty, and community members from around the state who are very interested in North Carolina foodways. Marcy Cohen Ferris is with us. She's a professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and we're joined now by Katie Kloon. Katie's a master's student in folklore at UNC Chapel Hill. Her thesis focuses on the Laotian community in Morganton, North Carolina. Katie, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Grateful to be here.
Tell us a bit about, first of all, how you got started, more about the Laotian community in Morganton and your interest in it.
Sure. I first learned about Laos while I was working at the Textile Museum in Washington, D.C., and fell in love with the woven arts there. And when I came to North Carolina, I knew that there was a population of Hmong and Lao living in the state. So I made it my mission to meet them and explore possible avenues for research, and found that instead of textiles, I was most interested in food and foodways, and was lucky to meet Toon Papaiboon, whose sister Dara runs Asian Fusion Kitchen, a restaurant that serves Lao and Thai food in Morganton, North Carolina.
And I suppose we should make this distinction now. You talked about Hmong and Lao. The Hmong people are the highland people of Laos, and the CIA worked closely with them during the war in Vietnam. When we pulled out, they were more or less left to the depredations of the new communist government. They were there, and they're the highlanders, and the lowland folk in Laos are also here. And there's a cultural distinction and not necessarily an ethnic distinction. We should just point that out, right? And they're all living in Morganton? Are there Hmong and lowland Lao as well?
Yes, there are more Hmong. Hmong started coming earlier to Morganton. The lowland Lao, which are Buddhist as opposed to animist, that's probably the best differentiation you can make between the two. There are fewer lowland Lao families, about 48 to 40 that I've been working with, but my research focuses very tightly with the Papaiboon family, and through them I've learned how traditional foods and cooking and sharing food with each other and with the broader community, they're actually helping to tell the story of their country.
This has so many connections in so many directions. The impact of Lao food in Morganton and that area of the state, the impact of Morganton on their traditions and their culture and what it has to do going generations forward. Pick one and start. And the community, Morganton, how has it embraced Asian fusion?
It's catching on. The family is just so hospitable. They are infinitely accommodating and have what they call a VIP table at the back where they kind of come and go throughout the day. But some of their regular customers have grown to be close friends with them and are also at the VIP table. They call the restaurant AFK, playing on CFK,
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
And I hear in Morganton that lingo is catching on. And Dara, the owner, recognizes that you're not going to invite someone in and give them the spiciest dish right away. You kind of ease the experience and start out with something more familiar like pad thai or fried rice.
So is the fusion between, say, pad thai and fried rice and then fried chicken, I mean, fused with what?
She describes her fusion as throwing Asia and America together a little bit. She learned how to cook from her mother, but does not serve very traditional Lao dishes on the menu up front. You can order Lao papaya salad, but beyond that, it's mostly Thai. And then she does cater to her American customers by integrating a little bit of Chinese foods like fried rice, or she describes a dish where she takes a spicy Lao pork sausage and actually serves it with potatoes, again, for that American customer base.
It's a great idea. How do you think that story fits into the bigger picture of ethnic food in the South in general?
Well, I think that across a table, it becomes easier to understand cultural differences. And for this family and the Lao community who have very little visibility in Morganton, sometimes they're mistaken for Hmong or Chinese. It's a very happy and comfortable way for them to represent themselves on their own terms and to get others interested and excited about this country, Laos, through eating papaya salad or sticky rice or pho or pad thai. I mean, those are Southeast Asian dishes that are more familiar, and then they can carry you on this journey to their homeland through its flavors.
It is the place where we get together. We all sit around the table, and I think to explore that even further, I'd like to introduce Sharon P. Holland. Sharon's a professor and associate chair of the American Studies Department at UNC Chapel Hill. Sharon P. Holland, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, you've been working and looking at food around North Carolina from a slightly different perspective. You're looking at borderlands.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, at first, when we started thinking about, we got in the room, we started thinking about borderlands. I think the best way to describe them would be to think of them organically, that borderlands aren't on the margin of what other aspects or other regions of the state are producing or what other foodways are there. Borderlands are like vestibules, or they become conduits for other kinds of connecting us to other regions in the world, other regions in the state. And so I got together with our TA, Victoria Blue Basis, and I spread the map of North Carolina barbecue on a table, thinking, well, we'd hit some barbecue joints on the way to the borderlands. And we basically mapped out our tastes. We mapped out the peoples we've encountered, and we also mapped out our memories of ourselves. And so we chose a few regions. One was Oxford, because my maternal family line is from Oxford. Another one happened to be south of Wilmington, down Route 17 on the way to South Carolina. And the third happened to be Charlotte, where there's actually, Victoria told me, has been a border dispute between South Carolina and North Carolina. And so I guess we began there.
So, and there are these literal borders, Virginia, absolutely, South Carolina, Tennessee, and all of that. But then there are also the cultural borders that you can explore,
absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the projects that I'm very much interested in, and because we're shaping this as we go along, I think the borderlands aspect of the course and the work we're doing in North Carolina is very new. So we're really interested in, I'm very interested in, the movement of the Chuck Taylor factory from Lumberton in 2001, I believe, to Mexico. And I'm interested in the cafeterias that might have existed in the factory or might not have, the brown bag lunches. I want to see if Victoria and I can both travel to Mexico and travel to the archives in Lumberton, if there are some, and really see if we can map foodways, which take us to so many different regions, not only the country, you know, but the world.
What would you learn? I mean, if you saw there were vast differences or predictable differences in the cafeteria in Lumberton versus what's going on in Mexico, what can that tell you about food and about the people who eat it?
I think it can tell us a lot. First, it can tell us exactly what's sustainable to the people in that place, what's shared among them. And also it can tell us about certain cultural differences, which will both, you know, fit in with what we might already know and also surprise us. And I think there ought to be a way to map the movement of industry from the continental United States to other places through food, which will both give us the politics, the community, and some of the ways of seeing the world.
You have seen the world, especially this question of food studies, through the lens of race, class, and gender, and come up with some interesting observations. Share some of them with us, will you?
Yes, I have. I come to this work through my work in critical race, feminist, and queer studies, and I think my most central food studies project to date has been in collaboration with Keila Tompkins and Marsha Ochoa on a special issue of GLQ on the visceral, which is to think about colonialization and the body and food, to think about race very deeply in that context. And so the other lens that I use to come to work in the borderlands is, I think, through that theoretical perspective. We have certain assumptions about who eats what and why. And I found through some of my work on what happens to the body and its engagement with food, that those questions are both interesting sometimes, take us in different directions, and the answers to them are surprising. So I think recently my work in those three areas has led to the work I do in animal studies as well.
What's the connection with colonialization, for instance?
The connection to colonialization is that when you think about the table and everyone sitting around the table, the very structure of the table itself is a colonial structure. It moves people from wildness, quote unquote, into civility. It's the introduction to, like, how does one, in a sense, play the part of citizen? How does one play the role at the table of ideas and at the table of at the community table? And so I think that colonization creates taste. It creates all the permutations of taste, and we need to pay attention to that initial creation.
It's interesting. I mean, socialization is critical to that, creating a nuclear family and suggesting it twas ever thus. Getting that in our head is a great way to enforce some of the other structures economically.
Absolutely.
And it starts at the table. Fascinating stuff. And I know you've studied this, Sharon Marcy. You pointed out in your book, and it's interesting, I never thought about it, but the idea that the civil rights movement, in many ways, that the front lines centered on lunch counters and or an ice cream parlor here in Durham, even before the lunch counters.
That's right, the Royal Ice Cream Shop. But everything that Sharon was just saying is really deeply what Southern history is about. You know, those experiences of colonization, of power, of the body, of African American, of enslaved bodies, and being, you know, African American voices, Indian voices in the South, those are really key foundational voices in Southern food. So it all comes back around. It leads us back to the civil rights movement, where those same voices are really demanding that they have a place at the table.
And very often, you know, food ways get co-opted and internalized. And we haven't even talked about Native American food ways and the way they've changed and, again, been sort of taken over by.
Yeah, and we'll be featuring Sarah Wood, an oral historian with the Southern Foodways Alliance, and Jeff Curry, a folklore graduate of our program, will be speaking about Lumbee Foodways and the famous collard sandwich. And we're actually having a collard sandwich reception.
Now, what time would that be?
That will be at 4:45 on Saturday afternoon. And Eric Fuller from Fuller's Barbecue in Lumberton is coming up and serving collard sandwiches. Do you know what a collard sandwich is?
I don't. Exactly?
So two thin little cornbread patties.
It's got two of my favorite things,
fried,
collards and
right.
You're right, say it again.
So you have thin cornbread patties, like as the sandwich, as the bun part.
Yeah.
And then you have sweet collards, and they have to be sweet, you know, so that you picked them over the wintertime. You've really gotten the best sweet collards. And then a little piece of fried fat back, like bacon.
Yeah.
And then hot sauce and chow chow to your own taste. And put that all together.
Ooh,
delicious.
That sounds good. So these are the things that we don't think about. But again, these are also sort of integrated food ways, I would think, that some of that may have been pre-Columbian and others followed, right?
That's right. And Melinda Mainolari says when you think about a term for Southern food, we should just say Indian food. That's at the heart.
But, you know, Sharon, it also gets to this other question of sort of whose food way is it? We think about Southern food, and in many cases this was African-American cuisine
right.
that was in some ways mixing, but it's and then has to be reappropriated in some ways.
Absolutely. It has to be reappropriated. And not only – this is the thing about food that's so exciting to me is that at that table you have so many voices, so many concerns, so many avenues to that particular dish. And one of the ways I've gotten to know my community is by offering a dinner for people to come together. I make something, and then we talk about our relationship to it, and it becomes – you create community at the same time that you're supposed to be representing community. So foodways are fantastic.
The state of the plate is the topic today on The State of Things. I'm talking with Marcy Cohen Ferris, a professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Sharon P. Holland is also a professor of American Studies. Katie Kloon is with us, a master's student in folklore. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the things. We think about food as a way of bringing us together, right? And so the international dinner was the thing we would do at our PTA. We'd have this at our elementary school to bring everybody in. And on the one hand, it was kind of a cool idea because everybody would get to sort of share their dishes. But I think unless you interpret it and understand where did this come from, maybe the full integration doesn't take place, Marcy.
That's right. You know, food is really an expressive language of culture. So that's what we care about here is it's really a deep way that we understand the South that we live in and the North Carolina we live in and how deeply we are shaped by global forces and by national forces today. So it's just another way. It's another tool. But it's a really important one because we all eat every day and it brings us together in ways that are really critical. But to make sense of our own North Carolina or our experience as North Carolinians.
And it's always changing. It's dynamic, a lot like language and many other sort of cultural artifacts. Katie, what happens in Hmong and Lao communities with second and third generations? Are they as enamored with their food as perhaps their parents are, or do they sort of fall away?
I don't think they think about it because it's around them all the time. And just as they're likely to go to Denny's and get brunch on a Sunday, they eat sticky rice and beef jerky and fried fish and pickled fish at home with their parents. So the family that I work with, Dara's daughter April, helps in the restaurant, but I believe she's about 17 and she's one of the oldest, so they haven't started cooking themselves. So that's when we'll really find out. But they love to eat it.
Marcy, I know another important aspect of this is public health and nutrition. Tell us more about that.
Well, Alice Ammerman is a faculty member that works really closely with us on the conference and brings in her graduate students who are doing incredible work really across the state. So Alice will be talking about her own work, but also featuring the kind of work that they're doing, mobile markets to reach low-income consumers across the state, demonstrations for how to use seasonal food, how to get more local food into supermarket chains, how to increase healthy food access through corner stores, all those kinds of issues that we really see, you know, facing food deserts across the state in Eastern Carolina. the University of North Carolina is really trying to engage with community in that way.
This is really the Holy Grail. You know, I'm, full disclosure, the president of the board of directors for the Durham Co-op Market. We just opened up last week. And the toughest nut to crack, and I think we've done a very good job, is making the food accessible. Why can't people on low incomes enjoy the healthy, nutritious food that those of us who are privileged get to have all the time? It's a I mean, I think we've done a pretty good job. I say that as a guy who has a vested interest, not vested interest, but certainly an interest in that co-op market. But it was very difficult for us, and I don't think we've done a good enough job yet. This is really the toughest challenge for all of us.
It goes back to the civil rights movement, right? And public accommodations and access. It's our right as citizens, as American citizens, as citizens of the state of North Carolina, that we should have access to healthy, good quality food, and that food costs money. You know, there's money that has to be paid to people to pick it and to process it fairly, and to everybody to have a stake in foods to nurture us.
So getting back to what Karen said, food should be expensive. It keeps us alive. What we need is an economy that allows people to have sustainable, well-paying jobs, meaningful work that allows them to pay for the food that's healthy and nutritious. And
creating those
food.
Sustainable food economies in North Carolina and around the world is really a central question in this conference, too.
Thank you all for being on the program. UNC Chapel Hill Professor of American Studies Marcy Cohen Ferris. Sharon Holland is a Professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Katie Kloon is a master's student in folklore at UNC Chapel Hill. They're all taking part in the State of the Plate conference happening at UNC Chapel Hill Friday and Saturday. It's at our website. Marcy's book is The Edible South. We've got information about that at our website, stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.